south old front riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. We've been reading Western short stories together for quite some time, and we've exhausted most of the classic Western short stories at this point. I've been digging deeper and deeper, trying to find stories that fit within our one-hour time frame, and it's become more and more of a challenge. But I recently came across an old magazine series called Cowboy Short Stories, published by Blue Ribbon Magazines, that I think you may enjoy. We'll be reading today from Volume 2, Number 4 of November 1939, and this issue cost 10 cents. Believe me, these authors pose no threat to Zane Grey or Louis L'Amour, but I got a kick out of the stories. They are all formulaic, good guy, bad guy, shoot 'em up westerns. And today we'll be reading Gun Orphan of the Owl Hoot, this by Ed Earl Repp. Its subtitle is A Heart-Appealing Novelette of a Kid Bandit's Struggle. Streaks of gun flame stabbed out through the darkness cloaking the rafter end houses and corrals. The deafening echoes of the ruckus increased as the battle became more determined, more fierce. But it was a losing fight for old Tully Moore and his young son Danny, making their desperate stand there in the smoke-choked living room. They couldn't stand off that gang of killers forever, and old Tully knew it was but a matter of time now before they closed in. 12-year-old Danny crouched in the deeper shadows of the long, rambling house, handing cartridges to his father as he called for them. His blue eyes were wide with terror as he waited hopefully for some twist of fate to save them from the inevitable. And now the clatter of hoofs lifted out of the night, and old Tully pumped lead faster. Danny could see riders swinging about the house, firing as they went. Occasionally one threw up his hands and slid from his saddle, grim evidence of the oldster's marksmanship, but it could not last. Then Danny became aware that his father's gun was silent. The oldster lay inert beneath the window. A sticky pool seeped out beneath his head. A scream clogged the youngster's parched throat as he scampered to his dad's side. And as he knelt down, he listened. The shooting had ceased, and he heard the clatter of hoofs as the riders mysteriously lit out. A surge of fury stabbed through him, and his small fists clenched into tight balls. But the sight of his parent flooded him with emotion. Tully Moore lay face down in a grotesque position beneath the window from which he had been firing. His rifle lay a few feet away as if it had been flung by one of the outstretched arms. Danny choked back a sob. Tears started streaming down his freckled face as he knelt beside his dead sire. Then suddenly, he buried his head on the inert form and wept bitterly. How long he lay this way, Danny did not know. It seemed hours, but it could not have been actually over a few minutes. When finally he arose, his eyes were dry but red-rimmed from crying. Dark hatred showed in his childish features as he looked around and saw several of the bodies of the attackers strewn over the yard. Now with a curse he stalked over and kicked savagely at one of the dead men. He turned again to the still form of Tully Moore. His voice was throaty and harsh as he spoke. "They didn't give you much of a chance, Dad," he grated, "but I reckon someday I'll even the score for you." And he went outside to cry a little more. So great was Danny's grief that he did not hear the muffled sound of approaching horses. When the riders were almost upon him, he caught a glimpse of them. He grabbed his father's gun and whirled to face the intruders. A heavy voice arrested him. "Don't make a play for it, kid." When Danny came into full view of the men, he found himself looking into the muzzle of a leveled revolver. He shook a little and lowered his own gun. He could see that the man covering him was large and beefy-jowled. He counted four other riders, and though Danny could not tell, it seemed that hard eyes were boring into him. "You killed him!" Danny charged savagely. "Damn you for the dirty skunks you are! You killed him!" The big man chuckled harshly. "I reckon you're wrong, youngster," he said. "We didn't kill him. Take a look at this. We found it in the yard."
The man lit down and handed Danny a soft object. As he took it into his hand, he saw that it was a bullet-shattered range hat. He examined it carefully. It was of dark gray felt and showed signs of much wear. It was covered with fine dust, and it carried a hoof print where one of the retreating horses had stomped it. After Danny had looked the hat over carefully, he raised his eyes. "What's this got to do with it?" he asked quizzically.
"Take a look inside," said the man.
He lit a match, and Danny examined the inside of the hat in the flickering glow. Suddenly his eyes went cold. There on the sweatband a name was inscribed in faded gold lettering. Slowly he spelled out the letters, Amos Whitcomb.
"Where'd you find this?" he spit out fiercely. "I told you in the yard," said the man, his tone edged. "One of them fellers must have dropped it."
"Amos Whitcomb!" An audible gasp escaped from Danny's lips. It seemed incredible that the owner of the neighboring Diamond K spread could have been with that gang of cutthroats. Tully Moore and Amos Whitcomb had settled in Wyoming years before Danny was born. They had homesteaded two sections of Whitewater Basin, and from those two sections had grown the biggest ranches in the basin. Danny had been as much at home at Diamond K as he had been at the Rafter Inn. Amos Whitcomb's daughter, Mary, had been like a sister to him, and Mrs. Whitcomb had been the only mother he'd ever known, as his own mother had died when he was born. There had been a little dispute lately between Amos Whitcomb and Tully Moore over the matter of a boundary line, but it hadn't appeared to be serious. Then Danny remembered grimly that in the past few months cattle had been mysteriously disappearing from the Rafter Inn. Things suddenly showed up in a clearer light, and the whole rotten business tied in together. With a pang of remorse, Danny thought of Mary Whitcomb. Often, in his childish fancies, he had told himself that he would someday marry Amos Whitcomb's auburn-haired daughter, but in his resignation to the fate that claimed him, he knew that any such ideas were suddenly swept away. An all-consuming hatred for the Diamond K owner surged through him. He vowed solemnly that someday he would return on equal terms with Amos Whitcomb, and then the score would be even. The big man's voice jarred him from his grim meditation.
"Do you know this feller, Whitcomb?"
"No," snapped Danny.
"You look like you're pretty much on your own now, kid," the man went on. "If you wanna, you can throw in with us. We're located up on the head of the Whitewater. Me, I'm Sedge Borkman." He introduced the other men in turn. "This is Trigger Sprague, Pete Banter, Nick Bolton, and this here half-breed we call Mike. He don't know his own name hisself."
Danny remained hard-eyed and sullen as Sedge Borkman spoke, and as he turned to each of the men, a shudder ran through his veins. Then, without a word, he started toward the tool shed. Borkman regarded him suspiciously.
"Where are you going?" he growled.
"I'm going to bury him," said Danny, flatly.
"Hell, kid," said Borkman. "There ain't no use in that. He's dead."
Danny whirled and spoke savagely.
"I told you I was going to bury him. Anybody got any objections?"
Sedge Borkman shrugged and winked at his men. "Okay, kid, if that's the way you feel. We just wanted to be traveling, that's all."
As Danny turned to go on his way, he caught a glimpse of Sedge Borkman moving toward the house. He suddenly remembered that somewhere old Tully Moore had gold hidden.
"What are you going to do?" he accosted Borkman.
"Just looking around," said Borkman.
"Well, you can stop looking," snapped the boy.
"Hell on the hoof, ain't you?" grinned Sedge Borkman. "You ought to make a first-rate wildcat someday, kid. If some Jasper don't take your taw before then."
Borkman cast an evil smile at his followers, and Danny did not see half-breed Mike Coyote back into the shadows and make toward the house. At the tool shed, Danny found his shovel and went about the task of burying his father. When he finished, he stood silently for several minutes over the fresh mound of earth. Then with a heavy tread, he moved away. At the corral, he caught his roan pony and saddled him. He decided to ride with Sedge Borkman and his gang. He didn't like or trust any of them, and they were patently a hard-bitten crew. But Danny had a desire to ride with hard men and become one of them himself. And he was certain that Sedge Borkman could teach him all of the tricks of the trade. He packed his meager belongings at the house and found the range hat that belonged to Amos Whitcomb. He jammed it on his head, and the hat fell down over his ears. He resolved to keep it as a reminder of a debt that he would someday repay. When he was finished packing, Borkman and his men were ready for him. They all mounted, and at a signal from the leader, they galloped out of the ranch yard. Danny's throat was tight as he cast one final look back at the ranch buildings before they disappeared from view. The first gray streaks of dawn lighted the eastern horizon when the cavalcade climbed into the maze of canyons at the upper end of the basin on the headwaters of the Whitewater River. The grassland in the sagebrush flats gave way to scattered patches of scrub pine and quaking aspen. The chill of early morning bit through Danny's thin clothing, but he paid no heed to the cold. When the sun had climbed over the hills, they pushed into a hidden canyon, and about a half mile further on, several small cabins hove into view. Danny could see signs of life about the cabins. Smoke curled from the chimneys, and the tempting aroma of cooking breakfast filled the morning air. The smell gnawed at Danny's empty stomach, and he suddenly remembered that he was ravenously hungry. As they neared the cabins, other men came out to meet them. They cast hard looks at the boy, and he saw that they were all the same caliber as those with which he rode. The fact that they were cold-eyed, swaggering gunmen was plainly marked by the presence of a low-tied six-shooter at every hip. "This is it, kid," said Sedge Borkman as he stopped and dismounted. "How'd you like to take on a little grub?" A feeling of fear and apprehension had gripped Danny from the time they first entered the canyon and glimpsed the cabins. But now the promise of food made him forget all else. It did not take Danny Moore many days at Sedge Borkman's camp to discover them for what they were, outlaws and cattle rustlers. He lay awake at night listening to them right away, and then he would hear them return before daylight, and the next day there would be activity in the corrals with the running iron. The thought terrified him at first, and then it began to appeal to his recently twisted sense of justice. Life had dealt harshly with him, he thought, and he seemed generally bitter toward society. Still, he was hesitant about throwing in with the gang. Even in his child mind, he could see that the Owl Hoot Trail was a long and hard one, and could only end in one place, Boot Hill. He never met with them on raids, but stayed and did odd jobs around the camp. One day he sneaked away from the hideout and rode back to the Rafter Inn with the hopes of finding his father's stolen money. He searched high and low around the house, but he could find nothing. Then the idea came to him. Amos Whitcomb had not stopped at murdering his father. He'd robbed him besides. As he passed the low mound that marked Tully Moore's resting place, a renewed desire for vengeance rushed through him. He rode back to the outlaw rendezvous, and the next day he was at the corrals watching them brand the stolen stock. Suddenly his eyes fell on the brands of some of the steers. It was the Diamond K. A sudden feeling of ruthless joy rushed through his veins. Amos Whitcomb was suffering at the hands of the raiders. Here was a chance for revenge. The die was cast. He would ride with Sedge Borkman's band of renegades. The years passed. Danny Moore had become a full-fledged member of the Rustler's crew. He was no longer recognizable as the skinny boy who had ridden away from the Rafter Inn. Time had added muscle and height, and in spite of his extreme youth, he had taken on as formidable appearance as any of the crew. His face was hard for that of a boy, and his pale eyes carried the glint of chilled steel. He became an expert with a running iron, and long hours of practice developed a fast and deadly draw. His name, too, had been cast away, and he was known only as The Kid. He rode with the gang on the rustling raids, and they wandered far from Whitewater Basin. Sedge Borkman was expanding, and cattle poured into the hidden canyon to be branded and driven on over the pass to be sold to unscrupulous buyers who paid for them and asked no questions. But always the kid felt a fiendish delight when a raid was made on the Diamond K. Rewards were offered for the riders, and posses were sent out after them, but they could never find the trail to the hideout. Little by little, the raids on the Diamond K became less fruitful. The kid knew that the great herds of Amos Whitcomb were dwindling, and that his huge reserve that he had built up in the past years was nearly spent. He felt a fierce satisfaction. The Diamond K owner was suffering as he had made Danny Moore suffer. Gradually, he put Mary Whitcomb out of his mind, and as he became more calloused, the memory faded. Then one night a raid on Amos Whitcomb's spread failed to bring back a single head. The next day the kid rode down there in broad daylight. A sense of ruin greeted him. Corral gates sagged open, and the ranch was totally devoid of stock. The windows of the house were boarded up, and the whole mess reflected emptiness. The loneliness fell about him, and he felt a little bit sick. Amos Whitcomb was ruined. The kid grinned, but the grin was a mirthless one. He told himself that at least he had his revenge, and although the thought was without conviction, he forced himself to believe it. As he rode back to the outlaw hideout, he couldn't bring himself to the satisfaction that he had anticipated all of these years. Time went on. 2 years rolled by, and it found the kid still riding the long trails. He found himself apart from the rest of his fellows now. He seldom took part in their gatherings, and when he sat in council it was for his own good or at the order of Sedge Borkman. From time to time, the other outlaws eyed him suspiciously, and the kid knew that they didn't trust him, but they never crossed him. They knew his gun was swift, and they gave him a wide berth. Sedge Borkman's owl hooters became more hard-pressed. Vigilante committees were organized, and bigger rewards were offered for their capture. And as the danger of capture became more acute, the raiding fell off. Several times one of the outlaws failed to return after a raid. Nothing was said, but each man knew that some posse man or vigilante had raked in part of the reward money. It was one evening about sunset that there was a loud flutter of hoofs down the canyon, and they all hurried to see a rider come wildly up the trail. Even from the distance, they could see that he was hanging grimly to the saddle horn to keep from tumbling from the horse's back. As he neared them, they could see his white, drawn face. "It's Nick Moulton!" someone shouted. "He's shot to pieces!" The horse raced into the clearing between the cabins and came to a stop of his own accord. The wounded renegade rolled from the saddle and crumpled to the ground. Sedge Borkman hurried over to the fallen man and raised his head up into his arms. Nick Moulton half opened his eyes. "What happened to you?" asked the big outlaw leader quickly. "A gang jumped me down in the basin," Moulton responded weakly. "They got me, but I had to get back. They," he faltered but managed to finish out, "they got on the trail, and they're a-coming here." Sedge Borkman shot up to his full height and let Nick Moulton drop heavily to the ground. The kid saw the wounded man's head snap back, and his eyes rolled once, and he was still. Nick Moulton was dead. "Get ready to ride," Sedge Borkman shouted out his orders. "The posse's on our trail. We can make it over the pass and get away." There was great activity around the corrals and buildings of the hideout. Men hastily caught their horses from the remuda and saddled them. Guns were loaded and food and ammunition were jammed into the saddlebags. Nobody carried a bit more than he would need, for the necessity of traveling light was urgent. When they were ready, Borkman gave the signal. "Ready, boys," he shouted. "Fall in." The kid made no move to mount his horse. He just stood with his blue eyes boring into the outlaw leader. Sedge Borkman saw it and clipped out impatiently. "Hit leather, you fool. We ain't got much time." "Ain't you forgetting something, Borkman?" said the kid slowly. "What do you mean?" snapped Borkman. "Are you aiming to leave Nick here for the buzzards to pick clean?" asked the kid. "Hell with Nick," ground out the big renegade. "We can't help him none.
We got to look out for ourselves. He was man enough to ride in and warn us when he knew we was dying, rasped the kid. The least we can do is to bury him decent. It was the outlaw Trigger Sprague who stepped up now and faced Sedge Borkman. He eyed the man levelly.
Yes, Edge, he said. The kid's right. We ain't gonna leave Nick here for the coyotes.
Maybe you forgot, you fellers, that I'm giving orders in this outfit, said Sedge Borkman evilly.
This time I'm giving 'em, Borkman, said the kid low and deadly. The fierce eyes of the renegade leader locked for a moment with the dead blue ones of the kid. Then he turned to his men.
All right, he shot out. Get a shovel, some of you, and get to work burying Nick, and hurry it up.
And rocks were placed over the grave to protect it from the coyotes. Then the others swung into the saddles, and Sedge Borkman led out in a gallop toward the low pass at the head of the hidden canyon. They rode long and hard, stretching their horses to the utmost. They hid out during the day and got what little rest they could, and when the first shadows of evening stole across the hills, they were in the saddle again. The kid rode sullenly apart from the rest of the gang now. The difference at the outlaw hideout had caused an open break between him and Sedge Borkman, and he realized for the first time how much he hated the big renegade leader. Constantly in his mind was the picture of the ruined Diamond K spread. The kid held no pity for Amos Whitcomb, but he was range-bred, and the thought of a once-flourishing ranch laid waste troubled him beyond words. Several days later, the band of renegades crossed the state line. They were a trail-weary and ragged crew. The days of hard riding told heavily on them. But now they rode less cautiously. They put a great deal of distance between themselves and Whitewater Basin, and with each day they felt less the danger of pursuit. The deep shadows of evening were descending now as they rode along a wide plateau close into the timber that fringed the foothills of the higher mountains. The peacefulness and the tranquility of the country made them jog along listlessly. They were prepared for nothing out of the ordinary when a harsh voice broke out over the gloom.
"Hold it, gents," it grated. "Stop where you are."
The curt command brought each one to an abrupt halt as he reined his horse savagely. They stood immobile for long seconds. Then they heard the strident shout of Sedge Borkman.
"We're trapped," he cried. "Make a run for it. That's our only chance. We'll meet up someplace."
A blue pencil of flame streaked out from his gun as he roweled his pony and they charged forward. The shot was answered by others and the place was suddenly a bedlam. There was a scream of terror as some of the bullets found their marks. Horses and riders were dashing madly back and forth to escape the deadly hail of leaden bullets. The kid leaned forward in his saddle and made a wild rush for a small clearing in the trees. His gun spoke savagely in the dash for safety. Suddenly he heard the shooting behind him, and he knew that he had escaped the gauntlet of gunfire. The echoes of the shooting died away as the kid goaded the pony forward, and they bored recklessly into the darkness along the rolling terrain of the valley. They raced down into gullies, up the other side, until it seemed that it had been hours since that short but fierce gunfight there in the edge of the timber. Then, as the kid started to slacken off his speed and give the pony his head, the animal lurched forward. The kid felt himself falling and then suddenly hit the ground with a sickening thud. It seemed that a million fire devils were shooting through his reeling brain. Gradually the reeling stopped, and a heavy blackness claimed him. When the kid returned to his senses, he believed at first that he had awakened from a wild nightmare. Slowly he pieced the happenings together, and he decided that the things he had been dreaming had really happened. He looked about him. It was daylight and the sun was shining brightly. The bright fiery ball had not climbed far into the heavens, so he knew that it was early morning. He was sitting in the bottom of a little swale, and lush grass was high and green all around him. A few hundred feet away, a small stream trickled mirthfully along its winding course. The kid sat up and rubbed his head where he had fallen from the horse. There was a lump there, and it was pretty sore. He was stiff and aching slightly from the fall, but otherwise he was all right. Now he lay back on his elbow and took in the peaceful scene that surrounded him. He looked up and saw fleecy clouds floating listlessly in the serene blue of the broad canopy that stretched from one horizon to the other. Somewhere a meadow lark sang gaily as if to offer him a cheerful morning greeting. Suddenly a feeling of loneliness and emptiness fell over him. He realized in that moment that he was sick of the life he had been leading. He realized that he'd been sick of it for years, but he was driven on by the rowling desire for vengeance. Now his vengeance was partly fulfilled, and the rest seemed far removed from this place, so far, in fact, that perhaps he could drive it from his mind forever. He knew that he hated Sedge Borkman and his whole slimy crew, with perhaps the exception of one man. Trigger Sprague had stood by him that last day in the hideout in the Hidden Canyon. The kid could figure no motive for the renegade's action, except that maybe Trigger had a speck more decency in his makeup than the others. The others, including Borkman, were patently afraid of him and tolerated him only because of his prowess with a six-gun. Now, as he lay there on the green meadow, a sudden desire for peace came over him. He wanted to settle down and forget the past. He could take up his name that he'd cast away many years ago, Danny Moore. He was in a new country, and he could start with a clean slate. He had been known during his outlaw career only as the Kid, and very few had actually seen him. Perhaps none but the members of the gang could really identify him. He had a chance, and if they came back trying to lure him to the old life, well, he still had his 45. He spent most of the morning looking over the land in the little glen. He located landmarks and surveyed as best he could the patch of ground. An idea was taking place in the back of his mind. Shortly before noon, he caught his horse and started out in search of a settlement. From a rancher in the valley, he got the direction of the town of Red Lodge. There he filed on a section in the little valley, and before evening he was headed back with a pack horse laden with the tools, food, and supplies necessary for starting a homestead. In the days that followed, Dan Moore found himself taking eagerly to his newly acquired life. From dawn to dark he worked tirelessly, and in the forge of honest labor a new man was molded. He whistled and sang at his work, and gradually it seemed that the past was a vague, dreaded specter of a life he would soon forget. For a cabin site, he located a wide, level spot nestled close to the sheltering brow of a small hill. The creek flowed past the door about 50 yards away. On the other side of the stream, he visualized other ranch buildings and corrals filled with stock. Someday there would be herds of cattle. There would be rafter and cattle, grazing on the bench land that led back to the timber. Down in the creek bottom was wild hay that would provide ample winter feeding. The fringe of pine forest that bordered the foothills of the higher mountains extended down into Dan's section, and soon his axe could be heard ringing as he felled the tall lodgepole pines for the start of his new home. With his pony, he snaked the logs to the cabin site, and there he cut and notched them. 3 weeks found the cabin up to the ridge logs. For a roof, he split thin, straight saplings and daubed the cracks with alkali, then covered the whole thing with dirt. In another week, he moved his possessions into the single room. A wild feeling of pride and joy rushed through him at this new sense of security and propriety. This was his home. He'd built it with his own hands, carved it out of a place where nothing had been before. It was a few days later, while Dan was busily engaged in his daily tasks, that he happened to look up and see a rider coming toward him. A sudden feeling of apprehension struck him, and for the first time since he had settled on his homestead, his mind flashed back to the deeds of his past. He could not recognize the horseman from the distance. The thought plagued him that it might be somebody who'd known him before. With a cool deliberation, he stalked into the house and strapped on his gun belt. He went outside and waited. Presently the rider came into closer view, and Dan came up with a start. It was a girl. A few moments later, she reined in at his side. "Good morning," she called cheerily. Now, Dan took notice of her. She was neatly clad in a pair of blue Levi's and a white shirt which, though it fitted loosely, did not hide the fullness of her bosom. She had brown eyes, light auburn hair, and her lips were delicately curved. A quick yearning toward Dan's heart. In his short and stormy life, women had been very much out of place. He had seen very few since he was a small boy. He found his mind dwelling on some vague, intangible thing that he had missed in his association with the hard men of his kind. He longed for the companionship he had been denied. "Howdy, ma'am," he drawled slowly. "I didn't expect to call her so early in the morning." "I was out riding," the girl replied, "and I saw that somebody was building up here in the gulch." She let her eyes stray around to the buildings. "My," she breathed, "you certainly have made progress. And such a lovely spot, too." "Ain't much yet," said Dan, swelling with pride. "But there'll be a lot more here some day." She dismounted, and Dan showed her the cabin and his work on the unfinished outbuildings and corrals. All the while he painted the picture of the ranch as it existed in his mind's eye, and the way that he hoped it would someday be in reality. He found the girl a ready listener. She showed a genuine interest in his work and in his plans for the future, and from time to time gave suggestions of her own. It was with reluctance that he accepted her statement that she must go. When he took her hand in parting, a sudden thrill shot through him that he could not account for. "I've enjoyed the visit so much," she told him. "It's always inspiring to see somebody creating something as you're doing here."
"It's meant a lot to me," Dan said slowly. "I've just realized how lonesome a man can be. You'll come again?"
"I will," she smiled. "I promise. Goodbye." She turned and the horse led off down the trail at an easy gallop. Dan marveled at the grace and bearing of the girl in the saddle. She was range bred, he knew, by the way she handled the horse. When she disappeared around the point of the hill, he found the loneliness more oppressive than ever. He went back to his work, but he could not put his mind to it. His thoughts kept turning back to the recent visit. He told himself that he was a fool, that she probably wouldn't come back again, and all the while he was hoping fervently that she would. Gradually, he was forced to admit that even from the short acquaintance, he was falling in love with the slim, auburn-haired girl. She did come back 2 days later. This time, as Dan watched her come into view, he felt his heart pounding heavily. When she dismounted and smiled in greeting, he thought that she was infinitely more beautiful than she had been the first time. They talked and laughed gaily. Dan felt a happiness that he could never remember having had. The girl complimented him on the progress he'd made since her last visit, though in reality it had been very little. Dan asked her to stay for dinner, explaining that it wasn't much and what he had was very crude, but she was welcome to share it. She accepted the invitation eagerly. "I'll help you," she said when Dan asked her to stay. She rolled up her sleeves and Dan was amazed at the dexterity with which she worked. She made biscuits in the Dutch oven, and soon the tempting aroma of bacon and coffee permeated the atmosphere of the one-room cabin. Dan ate heartily of the meal, and when he had finished, he sat back and started to roll a smoke. The girl leaned forward with her chin cupped in her hands and looked at him wistfully through her brown eyes. "You know," she began, "I've known you 2 whole days, and you haven't told me your name yet. I meant to ask you before, but somehow I just didn't get around to it." The abruptness of the question startled Dan, and he spilled a little bit of the tobacco from the paper. Then he remembered that the name Dan Moore had never been associated with any of his darkened past. He smiled faintly. "It's Dan Moore," he told her. The girl's eyes widened a bit, and Dan noticed it. "What's the matter?" he asked suddenly. "Oh, it's nothing," she replied. "It's just that the name made me remember something. I used to know a little boy by the name of Danny Moore, but that was years ago back in Wyoming. But there's really nothing startling in it. I've no doubt there's lots of people by that name." Dan lowered the half-rolled cigarette, and this time all the tobacco slid to the floor. He hunched forward and his brows lowered a bit.
"What is your name?" he asked slowly.
"I'm Mary Whitcomb," she answered, puzzled. "Why do you ask it in that way?"
The name struck like a thunderbolt in Dan's brain. Instinctively, his eyes shot to a shelf in the far corner of the room.
On the shelf lay a battered Stetson that he had discarded in hopes that it would let him forget something that he had once sworn never to forget. Now it all came back to him. Here was Amos Whitcomb's daughter sitting across the table from him, and Whitcomb himself was undeniably close at hand. In that split second, he lived again the horrible night at the Rafter Inn in Whitewater Basin. He was little Danny Moore, stealing out to see old Tully Moore shot to death and lying in a grotesque heap. His vow of vengeance flared anew. The hand of destiny had led him to Amos Whitcomb. Mary saw the transition on his features, but she could not read their meaning. "You're Danny Moore?" she faltered, her eyes wide.
"Yeah,"
Dan said simply. "Where have you been all these years?" she asked quickly. "We've wondered many times about you." She stopped a moment, then continued. "We saw what happened, and we tried to find you. Why didn't you come and live with us?"
"I just figured I wanted to quit the country," Dan lied. "And what about you? How did you get here?"
"We came here about 2 years ago," she said. Tears came into her eyes as she went on and told Dan about the hard times they had at the ranch. She told him of the rustling raids and how her father had used every cent he had to try to hang on and how he was finally forced to quit. "It was heartbreaking," she half sobbed, "to watch him give everything to try to save the ranch, and all the time he knew it was a losing fight. He was so crushed, so whipped when he finally had to turn the place over to the bank. Then we came to Idaho to try to start over again. He's done well, but the failure took something out of him." She now looked away from Dan. Her fists were clenched and her eyes filled with hate. "If I were only a man," she gritted, "I'd hunt those dirty thieves down if it took me the rest of my days." Her head fell into her arms and her shoulders shook with sobs. A bitter wave of self-condemnation swept over Dan Moore. He hated himself at that moment for having been one of the forces that ruined this girl's father. In reaping his vengeance, he had caused her to suffer. But then, Amos Whitcomb had caused him to suffer equally as much. He'd swept away everything that was dear to Danny Moore, and left only grief and hatred. Mary Whitcomb looked up once more. She'd stopped crying and was more composed. She forced a smile through her tears. "I'm sorry I acted so," she said, "but I was upset. You understand, don't you?"
"It's all right," Dan mumbled. "I know how you feel."
"I really must go now," said Mary. "It's been good finding you again after all these years. Dad and Mother will be happy to hear it, too. They've wondered so much about you. Please come and see us. We live about 5 miles down in the valley on the road to Red Lodge."
"I will," said Dan stiffly. And he knew that there was only one thing that could ever bring him to see Amos Whitcomb.
After she left, Dan was thrown into a cross-current of torn and conflicting emotions. He knew when he saw Mary disappear down the trail that she had ridden out of his life forever. Regardless of whether he loved her, she was the daughter of the man he hated, the man he had sworn, beside the body of his dead sire, to kill. That Amos Whitcomb had been the one that murdered his father, he was certain. The finding of the hat that night had stamped the idea indelibly in his child mind. The idea had grown with the years until it had become of such magnitude that it was a fact as far as he was concerned. Sane thought and logic were crowded out, leaving only one bitter belief. Amos Whitcomb had killed Tully Moore. All night long Dan tossed fitfully, restless with troubled dreams. When the early hours of morning came, he'd set on a hard, relentless plan. He would go to Amos Whitcomb's ranch and force a showdown with him. Then he would ride out of the country. Where he would go, he didn't know. Perhaps he'd find Sedge Borkman and seek once more the dim trails of the Owl Hoot. In the eyes of the law, he'd be a murderer. But in his own, he would be living by the principle that those who live by violence must also die by violence. His plans for settling down as a peace-loving cattleman were all swept away in one cruel stroke. The little cabin in the other buildings that he had put up in such a spirit of gaiety would fall into decadence and ruin. The short time spent on his homestead would be only a brief interlude in the life of one who was never destined to know the feeling of security and happiness. With the coming of daylight, Dan arose, but somehow he didn't start on his plan of vengeance. He told himself that he wasn't quite ready, that he would wait a while. He went on about his work around the ranch. It was a half-hearted effort, and he didn't sing and whistle now. His features were a cold, emotionless mask. Shortly before noon, he was suddenly drawn away from his work by the sound of approaching hoofbeats. He came up with a start. His first thought was that it was Mary Whitcomb come to visit him again. But when he saw the rider, he knew that it wasn't her. It was a man. He puzzled at who it might be until the man had come into close view. Then, suddenly, although Dan hadn't seen him for years, he knew that it was Amos Whitcomb. The years of hardship had told on Amos Whitcomb. His hair was gray and his shoulders were a little bit stooped. His face was more wrinkled and his long mustache was uneven, but he still carried his head high with a proud bearing, and in his light blue eyes there still burned a fierce determination. He rode up to Dan and called a greeting, and Dan grunted in return. "My daughter tells me you're Tully Moore's son," he said. "It's been a long time since we last met." He lit down and extended a gnarled hand to the younger man. Dan took it and cursed himself for being a hypocrite, but he noticed that the clasp was still firm. "That's right," Dan said curtly. "Danny Moore." "You don't know how happy we all are to see you, boy," said Amos Whitcomb. "We've wondered where you went after, well, after what happened. If you'd only come to stay with us, you was like our own son." "I didn't want none of your hospitality, Whitcomb," Dan said savagely. "I know you wanted to get away and forget, Danny," replied the old man. "That was your privilege, but it must have been hard sledding at times." Dan fought back the impulse to throw himself at Amos Whitcomb and choke the truth from him, but he couldn't do it. The rancher was unarmed, and he wasn't near a match for Dan physically. Amos Whitcomb went on. "I'm glad to see you're getting on so well here, boy," he said. "It's going to be good having you for a neighbor. And come down to our ranch often. We want you to." They talked on, and all of Dan's answers to the rancher's questions were short and blunt. Amos Whitcomb attributed Dan's bluntness to a bitterness that could only be erased with years. In parting, he said, "When you get stock here, youngster, watch 'em. We've had a little rustling trouble lately. I went through one siege of 'em, and it ain't nice, I'll tell you that." At the mention of rustlers, Dan instantly knew the answer. Sedge Borkman and his crew were riding again. Well, Dan could take care of them if they bothered him, and if they bothered Whitcomb, to hell with him. That was his lookout. Then he thought of Mary. If Borkman went so far as to harm her, Dan would settle the score with him. In the mental turmoil that gripped Dan as he watched the old man ride away, he was downright certain of one thing. He was going to have one hell of a time bringing himself to kill Amos Whitcomb. Throughout the day, Dan's thoughts plagued and tortured him. He made plans and rejected them. He alternately called himself a fool and a yellow-bellied coward. Several times he started to the Whitcomb ranch and then changed his mind. At nightfall, he had decided definitely to ride in and have the truth out of the old man. He caught his horse, strapped on his guns, and hit the trail. He rode hard, urging his horse to the utmost. His face was grim and his heart felt like a leaden lump in his breast. The lights of the Whitcomb Ranch buildings flickered through the fading light when suddenly Dan's horse shied away from the trail. Dan reined up abruptly and saw a dark form huddled on the ground before him. Quickly, he jumped from the horse's back and knelt beside the inert form. He lit a match, and in the pale glow, he recognized the face of the outlaw, Trigger Sprague. Dan pulled the renegade's head up and cradled it in his strong arms. "Trigger!" he said hoarsely. The man opened his eyelids a little bit and stared blankly into Dan's face. Then recognition struck him. "Damn me," he said weakly, "if it ain't the kid." "What happened to you?" asked Dan. "I guess I got my needin's," replied Trigger. "Me and Sedge had differences. He got the best of it. And as long as he is content to go along with rustling, I was willing to go along. When he wanted to go in for out-and-out robbery, I balked. So here I am." Dan was suddenly apprehensive. "Who was he going to rob?" he asked slowly.
"He's riding in tonight on Amos Whitcomb," said Trigger. He paused for a moment and then went on. "I want to tell you something else, kid. Whitcomb didn't kill your pa. Sedge Borkman did."
It took a few minutes for the import of Trigger Sprague's statement to soak in. When it did, it struck him like a lightning bolt.
"Sedge Borkman?"
he echoed hollowly.
"Yeah, Sedge did it," Trigger went on. "I'm about done for, kid. I want to go out with as clean a slate as I can. I wasn't always the dirty skunk that you knew. Anyway, that don't matter. Sedge planted that hat there that night. Where the hell he got it, I don't know. He figured you for a good gun material, so he thought if he could get you to hating somebody bad enough, he could get you to do most anything. He figured you being a kid like you was, you'd jump at the idea of Whitcomb being your pa's murderer. And he kept drilling it into you until you believed it when you grew up. Guess he figured right. You got a chance now to undo some of the wrong you did. You can't be to blame for it, but anyway, Sedge and two of the others are going to rob Whitcomb tonight. They heard he's got some money hid somewhere."
Trigger gasped for breath, but managed to get out the last few words.
"I'm going, kid. So long, and I hope to see Sedge in hell with me in a few hours."
His head rolled over and he was dead. Dan lowered Trigger's head gently to the ground and rose up to his full height. His fists were clenched until his knuckles were white.
"God," he cried suddenly and remorsefully, "what have I done?"
Like a man in a trance, he climbed into his saddle. He'd wondered why he couldn't bring himself to kill Amos Whitcomb. This was it. If there was any killing to be done, the former Diamond Cape rancher deserved to kill him. He'd caused a family an infinite amount of suffering. Could he ever atone for this awful wrongdoing? He swore solemnly that there was one way of partly making up for it. That was to take the life of Sedge Borkman. He rowelled the pony savagely, not knowing what he was doing. A red film of remorse and hatred covered his eyes as he flew along the trail, and the ugly face of the cruel renegade leader gyrated before his eyes. A few minutes later, the shadows of the ranch buildings emerged into view. All was peaceful and quiet, belying any threat of violence that hung over the place. Dan stopped and took close surveillance of all the surroundings, then cautiously dismounted and ground-anchored his pony in a grove of cottonwoods a little way from the house. Stealthily he approached the building, coyoteing into the shadows as he went. 20 feet from the porch he stopped and listened carefully. No sound penetrated the quiet of the night. The light was burning in the living room, and the house gave signs of occupancy. Dan breathed easier. It was apparent that Borkman had not yet struck. Dan took a step toward the lighted window, and suddenly a hard object jammed into the small of his back.
"That'll be far enough, my buckaroo,"
a voice sheared the evening quiet. Dan recognized it instantly as that of Half-Breed Mike. He stood frozenly for a moment. Then the faint spark of an idea took place in his mind. Mike had the drop on him, and there was no way of getting out of it. Slowly he turned around and looked into the renegade's gimlet eyes. He feigned surprise.
"Hello, Mike," he said, grinning faintly. "What's the idea of ramming the smoke pole in my gizzard?"
"The kid!" ejaculated Mike. "Where the hell you been? Sedge has been looking all over for you. Hell, I didn't know it was you."
He lowered the weapon.
"I figured."
Dan leaped at the fleeting opportunity. His fist lashed out and he caught the outlaw flush on the point of the chin. With a groan, he reeled backward and fell to the ground. He was out cold. Dan had tried to be as quiet as possible, but considerable commotion was caused by the slugging of Half-Breed Mike. Suddenly, the front door of the ranch house came open and a shaft of light fell out across the front. A figure appeared at the door. Dan knew instantly that it was Mary Whitcomb.
"Who is it?"
she asked, straining her eyes through the darkness. Dan felt sudden fear for the girl lined against the light in the doorway.
"Get back inside, quick!"
he shouted at her. Before he had hardly finished speaking, a shot rang out and a blue pencil of gunfire leaped out at him from the shadows. Dan felt a sudden sharp burning pain where the bullet grazed him on the shoulder. There was a scream from Mary Whitcomb, and with a lightning draw, Dan pulled his gun and targeted the flame toward the clump of bushes. There was a sudden curse and a groan, and he knew that the bullet had found its mark. He hurried over to the place where the sound had come from, and he saw a man sprawled out in a lifeless heap. He gave a quick glance at the man's face and saw that it was Pete Banter, one of Borkman's henchmen. That was two of the renegades down. Half-breed Mike would be out for some time, but Sedge Borkman was still somewhere close. The outlaw leader had no doubt seen Pete Banter go down and was hiding out for a chance to get a shot at Dan. It would be a waiting game, Dan knew, with one of them trying to get the advantage on the other. Mary stood on the porch, transfixed with horror at the quick succession of events. Amos Whitcomb had appeared at the door and was now racing down the step to see what was wrong. Dan could see a movement inside the house, and he knew that Mrs. Whitcomb was also coming to find out what had happened.
"Mary, go back inside!"
Dan repeated his order fiercely. He shouted to Amos Whitcomb to get out of the way. Presently, a shadowy figure darted up on the porch and grabbed the girl and backed away toward the outside. In the shaft of light, Dan saw the ugly features of Sedge Borkman.
"All right," he growled. "If you shoot at me, you'll get her first."
Mary gave a sharp outcry and she struggled in the renegade's grasp. Dan started toward them and he saw Borkman raise his gun. In the face of certain death, Dan continued. Sedge Borkman leveled the gun and took careful aim. He could afford to do so, for he knew that Dan would not dare to fire at him while he had the girl as a shield. Suddenly, Mary tore an arm free from the renegade's grip. She flung it at Borkman's gun hand, and at the same time the gun went off, but she'd spoiled his aim enough that the bullet went whining over Dan's head. Like a springing cougar, he flung himself at Sedge Borkman and the girl. At the same instant, the outlaw leader threw out his arms to protect himself, and Mary pulled herself away. Dan swung a fist at Borkman's gun arm and sent the weapon spinning. Now he waited in a crouch for Dan.
"So it's gonna be that way, huh, kid?" he snarled. "Well, come ahead. I can take you with fists or guns. It don't make no difference."
"You know I'm gonna kill you, don't you, Borkman?" shot out Dan. "In case you don't, I saw Trigger a little while ago. He told me the whole story."
Sedge Borkman made a lunge at Dan, and the younger man stepped lightly aside. At the same time, he drove his knotted fist hard into Borkman's belly. Borkman doubled up momentarily, but he was out of it in the same instant. He swung a wild haymaker that caught Dan on the side of the head. Dan reeled and he felt dizzy, but he shook his head and bored in more savagely than before. Now both men were in close, swinging sledgehammer blows with reckless abandon. Dan backed away to duck one of Borkman's wild swings, and as he did so, his foot caught a small boulder and he tripped and fell backwards. Borkman came at him and jumped with both feet aimed at Dan's head, but Dan rolled away just in time, and the impetus carried the big man to the ground. They grappled there without getting up. Borkman caught Dan around the chest with his powerful arms and started squeezing. Dan felt that his bones would surely crack under the terrific pressure, but some indomitable spirit forbade him to give in. Mary Whitcomb, her mother, and her father all stood by speechless. They all knew that this was a fight to the finish, that it wouldn't be over until one or the other was dead. Suddenly, Dan wriggled free of Borkman's grasp. He rose half up and sent another smashing blow into the renegade's face. Then his hand went out to Borkman's throat. With all his might, he gripped. Borkman kicked and thrashed, but Dan held on like a bulldog. His fingers began aching unmercifully, but he only gripped all the harder. Then Borkman's kicking and squirming became less violent. His tongue rolled out and his face became purple. Suddenly, there was a loud snapping noise, and the renegade ceased to fight. He lay still, and Dan relinquished his hold. Dan rose up slowly, his clothes half torn off him and his face cut and bleeding. Mary moved a step toward him and then suddenly she stopped. Her eyes went wide with terror.
"Danny, look out!" she gasped.
Dan whirled to see the fallen outlaw half-breed Mike leveling a gun at him. He'd forgotten all about Mike and the fierce struggle with Sedge Borkman. Now Mike had the drop on him again as he had it earlier in the evening. This time Dan was unarmed. He'd lost his gun in the fight. As he looked into the bore of Mike's six-gun, he realized that death was only seconds away. The reverberation of the gun echoed through the night, and to Dan's amazement, he saw Mike throw up his unfired weapon and plunge over into the dust. He whirled just in time to see a smoking gun in Amos Whitcomb's gnarled fist.
"I reckon that kind of makes this even, son. You saved my bacon and I saved yours."
"I owe you two bits change," grinned Danny as Mary Whitcomb rushed toward him. She cried, "Danny, you're hurt."
"Not bad," he said and turned to his horse. "I'll be going now."
"No, you won't, young man," another voice shirted him. "At least not until you've fixed yourself up some." He turned to see a small gray-haired woman looking at him, smiling at him in motherly fashion. He guessed she was Mary's mother, and he liked her. She set up a strange longing deep within him. "Mother Whitcomb," he murmured softly.
"That's right," the old lady stepped toward him, "and it's about time somebody took you in hand. I'm not going to have my boy running off the first thing."
And she took him by the arm. Mary closed in on him from the other side. A slow smile built on his rugged face.
"Reckon I'll be staying," he said, a new happiness claiming him.
He turned to Mary. Her brown eyes were smiling. He knew then that he would have come just to see them again, and he resolved never to leave her. Tonight, he had in some measure paid part of his great debt to them. He knew that as years rolled by, he would be able to repay in full by simple faith and devotion. Amos followed them to the house, smiling. And that was The Gun Orphan of Owl Hoot by Ed Earl Repp. Thank you for joining us for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky and up a cloudy draw. Aye,
if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.